this mass multiracial, not to mention multigendered and many-aged movement is led by people who occupy the lowest rungs of America's ladder of race and class, black women.
This is COVID Race and Democracy.
And businesses are shutting down while some of these giant essential businesses are thriving and yet have relaxed on safety.
In today's edition, we look back at how frontline food, clerical, and healthcare workers are fighting to survive the coronavirus.
And the embers are there to fight back. We really just need to bring those groups of people together, bring that labor movement together to fight for our rights.
We remember the death, murder of George Floyd that sparked outrage worldwide and the valiant service of Los Angeles public and mental health care workers fighting for the health and safety of our nation.
Because he's been locked up for 44 years. That's a long time. And he's 76 years old.
We will hear also of the struggles of Leonard Peltier and the battle for his life, as well as the fight for justice for people of color who were victims of police violence this year, including Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and Elijah McClain.
That last principle in Kwanzaa or the Nguza Saba, which is faith, you fight for that just like you fight for the ability to unify, to see the uniformity and that which we have lost.
Our second half will feature Bukim Nyerere of NACO, National Association of Kawaita Organizations, as we highlight the historic 54th anniversary of Kwanzaa, created by Dr. Maulana Karinga. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt.
I remember the days when our prayers were illegal. I remember the days when being Indian was lethal. Yeah, we had a rough past, but get ready for the sequel. Get ready for the glorious comeback of our people. Oh, yeah. Rise up.
Lenny Foster expressed his love and concern for his friend Leonard Peltier, an internationally known Native American political prisoner and indigenous activist originally with the American Indian Movement. For over three decades, Lenny served as a spiritual counselor and advocate for incarcerated indigenous people. He maintained a friendship and facilitated indigenous ceremony to Leonard consistently over decades.
And one of my most notable clients that I had for 35 years was Leonard Peltier, the foremost Native political prisoner in the United States prison system. It began in the United States Penitentiary, Leavenworth, Kansas. Now at this time, he's incarcerated in the United States Penitentiary, Coleman, Florida. Maximum security. It was difficult. Because the prison officials don't want to see that opportunity for Leonard Peltier to have spiritual visits. He's had three spiritual leaders through the years, Archie Fire, David Chief, and myself. We advocated for his right while he was incarcerated and helped his humanity and maintain his sanity. Because he's been locked up for 44 years. That's a long time. And he's 76 years old. And he's experiencing some bad health. He's got heart problems, high blood pressure, diabetes. So, and then his prostate. He's isolated himself, wearing a mask. Doesn't venture too far from his cell because of the coronavirus that are in these prisons. And USP Coleman, Florida is infected with the coronavirus, so he's very anxious, very difficult for him because he's been cut off from any visits or any phone calls. He's been locked down for the last 6-8 months. Best I can do from here is to pray for him every morning, include him in my prayer, and I'm looking forward to 2021 where I can go visit him, sit with him, and smoke the pipe and pray with him. The last couple of years that I was able to visit him, we only visited in the visiting room. The warden wouldn't allow the sweat lodge ceremonies. We just have to do the best we can under the conditions that exist for us.
Lenny Foster, longtime advocate of incarcerated Indigenous people's rights. The Trump administration has opened Alaska's coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas development. The sealed bids for leases on the refuge will be revealed on January 2, 2021, just 2 weeks before President-elect Biden takes office. Bernadette Dementev is the executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee. The refuge is part of the Gwich'in people's ancestral homeland.
We represent 15 communities throughout Alaska and Canada, and I am from Fort Yukon, which is 8 miles above the Arctic Circle. The Gwich'in Nation have had a spiritual and cultural connection to the porcupine caribou herd since time immemorial. Protection of the birthing and nursing grounds is a human rights issue. The caribou are the foundation of our culture and our spirituality. They provide food, clothing, and tools, and they are the basis of our song stories and our dances. There was a time when we were able to communicate with them, and we made a vow to take care of each other. Believe in yourself. Your ancestors are with you. If you have it in your heart, you have it. It is our responsibility as human beings to take care of this land, to take care of our water, to take care of our animals. Our animals cannot speak. They cannot tell us that they are sick, that they are starving. They cannot tell us that we are hurting their habitat. Whether you're Indigenous, white, black, we have a responsibility to keep a healthy environment for our future generations. Regardless of this 30-year fight that we've had with this government, our elders, they told us to go out and tell the world that we are here. Do it in a good way. Today, I ask you to stand with the Gwich'in Nation. Protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We are all interconnected up here to our land, water, and animals. And if our animals and our land is sick, then we are sick. Our ancestors, they worked hard for us to be here. We owe that same dedication and respect to our future ancestors. On behalf of my people, Masicho and Apasi, thank you.
Bernadette Dementev on protecting the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The International Indian Treaty Council's executive director is Andrea Carmen. She is a member of the Yaqui Nation, and she talks about the current issues facing Indigenous people today.
The most critical issue that I feel is affecting our survival on the ground is climate change, the climate crisis. It affects biodiversity, it affects our foods, it affects our ceremonies. And then on top of that, now we have the effect of COVID-19, and they're very closely related because a lot of the vulnerabilities of Indigenous peoples is related to the poor condition in many places of our health and lack of access to health services. But a lot of the health issues we're facing in the United States, like obesity and diabetes and asthma, those kinds of things are directly related to the ongoing environmental contamination and environmental violence on our lands, as well as lack of access to our traditional foods and seeds and methods, the ongoing issues of violation of our land rights, our treaty rights, our cultural rights. But I would say the most critical crisis situations we're facing are the combined impacts and interrelated impacts of the climate crisis and the crisis in our communities, where a lot of our elders and traditional knowledge holders are also, you know, passing away before their time because of COVID. You know, it relates directly to our ability to be resilient, to protect our traditional knowledge and ways of life.
Andrea Carmen, Executive Director of the International Indian Treaty Council. Special thanks to producer Jacqueline Baptiste of KPFT.
United we're as strong as a mountain. United we're as deep as the sea.
Stand together, shoulder to shoulder, sisters and brothers, united and free.
Food processing workers, grocery clerks, and healthcare workers' lives are in danger. Kim Cordova is president of UFCW7, which represents workers in Colorado and Wyoming. She and her locals have been fighting for protection. She also picketed OSHA in Denver for the failure to enforce health and safety laws. Pacifica talked with her about this catastrophic year for their members.
I represent food processing, packing house workers, grocery store workers, and healthcare workers, as well as barbers and cosmetologists. So our workers have been on the front line since the beginning of this pandemic. So they've all been deemed essential workers. You know, it varies by company, but I will tell you, because of the stance that this administration took, you know, downplaying COVID, a lot of the employers, their response was either late or inadequate. And that proved to be very harmful or deadly to our members. You know, there were, the CDC issued different type of guidance, first saying do not have workers wear masks. And then they again changed their guidance to allow frontline workers to wear masks. And I will tell you, the masks were a big deal. Without the masks, like in our packing house, workers got very sick, landed up on ventilators, some ultimately died. And most of that happened before masks were distributed into their facility. And that's at our packing house at our JBS plant. In our grocery stores, they also were not given masks immediately or other safety interventions. I mean, in retail and also food processing, the social distancing issue is a very big problem. You just don't have control over your environment. We went to the governor for our retail grocers, asked the governor to intervene and help us deem our workers essential so that they got some of the safety interventions put in place. But it took a while, and the virus already started to spread throughout some of our facilities. We lost 3 grocery workers. They died of COVID. And then 6 of our packing house workers. There were also other deaths of either family members or workers that may have been exposed from the actual employee. It's part of the systemic racism that we see within our own economy. These workers, because of the makeup, the Latino immigrants, refugees that work in these type of jobs or facilities, African-American workers, they've been treated as disposable, as sacrificial employees, as fungible widgets, you know, and it's part of the systemic racism that we see. Safety was not treated or was not a priority for these employers or for our elected officials. OSHA has been defunded and deregulated. There's been no enforcement oversight of safety. In fact, I mean, there's been so much deregulation for workers' safety with this current administration that really COVID just exposed what they were going through on a daily basis. I mean, and you add in some of these jobs are some of the most dangerous jobs in the country, especially in a packing house. And then you add a virus that's airborne in so close to each other that workers died in this plant. And because these employers treated these workers or our elected leaders just turned their back on them when they needed them the most. We actually picketed OSHA for their failures. We went out and did a protest in front of OSHA's main office in Denver. And they just started to interview workers in one of our grocery stores where not only 2 workers died of COVID, but they also, we had a massive outbreak of COVID-19 at that facility, and they refused to issue any type of citation to that employer. They've just been absent. It's been the biggest failure of our government I've ever seen. We've had our government just fail their constituents by fighting over whether or not these big corporations should be protected and not liable for their negligence if workers died on the job. And it's unconscionable to sit back and think that right in front of all of our eyes, frontline essential workers have died. I mean, and not just workers, but you know, over 200,000 Americans have died because our government has downplayed COVID. and businesses are shutting down while some of these giant essential businesses are thriving and yet have relaxed on safety and really have put their workers out there to be sacrificed. And again, it's part of the systemic racism that we see within our own economy and within our country. We don't see our government officials, elected leaders standing up for workers in this country, the backbone of our economy. Look at Kroger. Kroger and Safeway Albertsons, a lot of these grocers, you know, they came out and they deemed their employees heroes, right? At the beginning of the pandemic, they put up billboards, put commercials out, awarded them what they called, it was hazard pay, but they called it hero pay. And then on May 17th, they just decided to strip that away from workers and relax on safety interventions. And in the middle of a pandemic, we were still in the first wave of the pandemic. And they took away this, just a small $2 worth of hazard pay, which meant a lot to frontline workers. And then they announced these giant bonuses for their CEOs. And now the numbers of COVID cases in these retail grocery stores have just gone up incredibly at an alarming rate. And, you know, workers continue to get sick while the companies continue to profit. Small businesses are closing, restaurants are closing, you know, the mom and pops are losing, you know, their livelihood, their businesses. And we got these big giant corporations whom are making massive profits, but then yet are not protecting their workers that are responsible for every penny of their profit. It is absolutely absurd what we have seen, the greed in this country. So many people judge the wealth or the economy by how well the rich are doing and not how the real people are struggling in this country. And, you know, they don't have to. I mean, you know, they've made COVID really became a political issue. A mask is a political issue. Personal protective equipment in this country has become a political issue. You look at retail grocery workers, and many of them are children. It's their first jobs. You know, many people start in as a box boy, as a courtesy clerk, or a bagger in a grocery store. And customers refuse to wear a mask because it's a political statement and putting other people at risk. And we just are not our brothers and sisters keepers anymore in this country. And we are so divided in this country over the silliest things. And poor workers are in the middle of this political debate and this fight. And it's something in my lifetime I'll never forget, or it's really hard to forgive what has happened. It's been really such a failure on so many levels that we need real change in this country.
That was Kim Cordova, president of UFCW7. Cordova says her members are dying because of the criminal inaction of the companies, OSHA, and governmental officials.
Brothers and sisters, when they insist we're just not good enough.
That we're not good enough, yeah.
We're no better. Just look them in the eyes and say, we're gonna do it anyway.
We're gonna do it.
We're gonna do it anyway.
We're gonna do it.
We're gonna do it anyway.
The London African Gospel Choir unites all denominations and nations into an ensemble that delivers a repertoire reflecting African and Caribbean diversity. On December 23rd, they performed this song outside Bill Marsh Prison on the outskirts of London for imprisoned WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange.
We're gonna do it anyway.
So strong,
oh,
something inside.
the London African Gospel Choir, performing outside Bill Marsh prison for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. A British court is set to rule on January 4, 2021, on whether Assange should be extradited to the United States to face criminal prosecution for the publication of secret documents through the whistleblower platform WikiLeaks in 2010. Thanks to KPFA's Ann Garrison for filing this report. You're listening to COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Justice for victims of police violence against people of color dominated the news this past year. Verner Avery Brown of Pacifica's WPFW in Washington, D.C., brings us the voices of journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, and renowned educator Jane Elliott.
As people worldwide respond in solidarity to the brutal, cold-blooded murder of George Floyd at the knee of a white cop, one commentator sees this moment in history as one that's giving birth to a new movement. Renowned incarcerated journalist and commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The other women's movement. It occurred to me that the organizers of this new movement are women. This movement, this mass multiracial, not to mention multigendered and many-aged movement, is led by people who occupy the lowest rungs of America's ladder of race and class. Black women, mostly very young black women. They have seized the hour and brought forth people from almost every segment of society. They are the nucleus of the Black Lives Matter movement, and they are ringing the bells in the night, warning America and the world that the American house is on fire. We're in the midst of a movement, kind of like chilling in the eye of a hurricane, and everything is being shaken, if not removed. What a day. What an hour. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
In a widely publicized speech on the 4th of July, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam addressed the individuals who have died from the coronavirus, labeling them as martyrs rather than victims. He also issued a sharp rebuke of any U.S. vaccine that might become available to the public.
I'm about to ask the government relieve our brothers and sisters in Cuba of the unjust burden of your embargo. Because we're not going to take no medicine that you, the killers of all of us, remember the syphilis experiment? Remember what they did to the Native Americans with smallpox? Remember the vaccine that they gave us for polio that was cancer itself? So how in the hell could you trust them with a vaccine after you know what they have done and that they're capable of doing it again on a bigger and broader level? We will not accept your vaccine.
Yes, sir.
So you can slow down, because whenever you bring it out, it's for your people. You give it to them, because we are not accepting death. So I'm saying in this election year, tell Mr. Trump, release Cuba, because we want our Cuban doctors to look after us. We don't trust you. We can't trust you no more, white folks. Not with our lives.
The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam. His silence was deafening. It was 100 degrees in Salt Lake City, Utah, as U.S. Marine Todd Wynn, dressed in full military uniform, stood silently for 3 hours with his mouth taped shut to protest the police murder of George Floyd. On the tape covering his lips, the words, "I can't breathe," were written. Wynn held a sign reading "Justice for George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Tamir Rice, and countless others." During an interview with CBS News, Wynn said his time with the Marines changed his perspective, and he was able to let go of what he called the small-minded ideas he grew up with. "You know, until I left home and joined the Marine Corps, I didn't really understand that that was wrong. Until I served with men whose skin was a different color than mine, who were the finest men that I've ever known. They helped me to learn that, really, we're all the same." when is white. And that is precisely the lesson that noted American educator, anti-racist activist Jane Elliott sought to drive home to her class of white third graders when she engaged them in an exercise that's come to be known as the Blue Eyes, Brown Eyes exercise. Jane Elliott.
This is a special week. Does anybody know what it is?
National
Brotherhood Week. What's brotherhood? Treat everyone as though he was your brother. And is there anyone in this United States that we do not treat as our brothers?
Yes.
Who?
Yes. The black people.
Who else?
Indians.
Absolutely, the Indians. How are black people treated? How are people who are of a different color than we are treated?
They don't get anything in this world.
Why is that?
Because they're a different color.
You think you know how that would feel to be judged by the color of your skin? No, I don't think you'd know how that felt unless you had been through it, would you? It might be interesting to judge people today by the color of their eyes. Would you like to try this?
Yeah!
Sounds like fun, doesn't it? Since I'm the teacher and I have blue eyes, I think maybe the blue-eyed people should be on top the first day.
Seemed like when we were down on the bottom, everything bad was happening to us.
The way they treated you, felt like you didn't even want to try to do anything.
What happened at recess? Were two of you boys fighting?
Russell called me names and I came in the gut.
What did he call you?
Brown eyes.
What's wrong with being called brown eyes?
It means that we're stupid.
I watched what had been marvelous, cooperative, wonderful, thoughtful children turn into nasty, vicious, discriminating little third graders in a space of 15 minutes.
Does it make any difference whether their skin is black or white?
No.
Or yellow?
No.
Is that how you decide whether people are good or bad?
No.
Is that what makes people good or bad?
No.
Now you know a little bit more than you knew at the beginning of this week.
Yeah.
Educator, anti-racist activist Jane Elliott, she first conducted her famous exercise for her class on April 5, 1968, the day after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated.
Produced by Lona Alliance and Verna Avery Brown of WPFW Washington, D.C.
Yeah, imagine living like a black man. Yeah, imagine living like a black man. Yo, a black man in America, sorta kinda like being treated just like a terrorist. Living how I'm living, it's really no comparisons. They systematically trying to kill us, now that's the scariest. I swear the numbers getting various, I'm feeling like I'm Harriet. An underground soldier for my people that I'm carrying. They killed George Floyd, now I'm trying to fill the void. This the life my brother's living, it's really hard to avoid. I keep my hoodie on for Trayvon, I do it for my day ones. Sandra Bland spoke about the path that we should stay on. I can't breathe through this nonsense. The killings coming constant. The crooked politicians is never willing to stop this. Yeah, Breonna Taylor, say her name, say it again. Breonna Taylor, say her name until we win. I pray to God daily, deliver me from my sin. Trying to start a revolution, and here is where we begin. Yeah, if you want some change, you gotta model it. What else? Yeah, speak about your feelings, never bottle it.
Over 2 million people in California have been infected with COVID-19. And the numbers are escalating. Hospitals are out of ICU beds and people are dying. Governor Gavin Newsom has given a pass to keep the massive Tesla plant in Fremont open with 15,000 workers. The health department says it is an essential industry and many of the workers are bused back and forth from the plant to Central Valley where the virus is reportedly out of control. Should billionaires like Musk, Tesla's owner, be held accountable for lack of protection for the auto workers and the people of California? Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer interviews Los Angeles County SEIU 721 mental health care workers Julia Wallace and Lawrence Reyes, who is also a programmer at KPFK.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica. A major center place of where the virus has struck is in Los Angeles. Now, where hospitals are basically overloaded and people who are getting sick are not able to be taken care of. And one of the issues of the COVID crisis in the United States is the question of mental health and how people are being affected, young people and elderly and everyone by this mental health crisis. And two of the people who are joining us on Pacifica, Julia Wallace, who's a mental health worker in Los Angeles and with SEIU 721, and also Lawrence Reyes, who is a mental health worker in the same local SEIU 721. And they've been dealing with the COVID crisis and how it's affected them as workers trying to deal with this, and also their clients and the public. Welcome to Pacifica.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Julia, why don't you talk about this COVID crisis and how it's affected Los Angeles and preparation for it or no preparation for it, and what it means now to the millions of people who live in Los Angeles?
So the COVID crisis as it stands now has really changed. A few months ago, in the summer months, there had been an act to put people, the homeless population and people living with mental health disabilities in pop-up recreation centers. Now they've closed a lot of those recreation centers. And since the surge has happened, they haven't had any plans or shown any plans to reopening these places. And it's a real issue for folks because even though the virus in some ways has been normalized, people are still dying in record numbers, and there hasn't been a serious effort to respond to the surge of the virus in these last few months. And so that's led to more people being homeless. That's led to a decompensation for a lot of our folks. So their mental health illnesses have been worsened, as well as just people who haven't had as many mental health disabilities being more affected by the virus. Black people and Latino people are disproportionately getting COVID and dying from COVID, and working class people in general are getting it and dying from it. This is something that's always been a problem within our communities. Always the worst healthcare, negligent services, and cutting services. And even more so, we're the ones that are the frontline workers, the essential workers. And when they say essential workers, they don't just mean nurses and doctors. These are folks that work at McDonald's. These are folks that work at Amazon. And they're not getting the protection that they need. And I think it's important for us also, you know, as people who are rank and file members of labor movement of unions, to also be saying that we should be speaking out for those folks too, folks that aren't members of unions as well. Because, you know, their struggle is our struggle. And I think that just lastly, that this system under the Democrats and Republicans has no interest in protecting working class people, and it never has. And so it's important for us to also, you know, as members of SEIU, as members of other unions as well, for people to really stand up and to say that, no, this is not acceptable. And since we're so essential, that we need to be organizing to shut down or, you know, possibly go on strike to say this isn't okay. Even $2,000 isn't enough. They gave trillions of dollars to the wealthiest people and corporations in the history of the world. $2,000 is nothing.
This is a crime against humanity, as far as I'm concerned. You know, the whole idea of these pop-up shelters, and it's not only COVID, but it's gotten colder out here in Los Angeles. It's gotten really cold. And the cold weather shelters would not be able to accommodate the kind of challenges that Julia talks about with our people who are challenged with mental health issues. And also they are challenged with the kind of trauma that they experience as a result of being unhoused and being homeless. And the county has not responded in any way. In fact, there's a call to Governor Newsom and Mayor Garcetti to open up Los Angeles to the Cuban medical diplomatic corps that Cuba has been offering Los Angeles ever since this recent surge, and even before the recent surge. So there's a group, U.S. Hands Off Cuba Los Angeles, that are having an event on Sunday calling for, demanding that the Cuban medical diplomatic corps be sent to Los Angeles to help deal with the shortages of frontline workers, healthcare workers, nurses and doctors, because Cuba, as you know, is prepared to respond, help out in this crisis.
You know, this last summer, we had an upsurge of youth in the Black Lives Matter movement against police brutality. And even before that, there was a fight of public education workers, UTLA in particular, went on strike, and other teachers went on strike around the country. So we really have the potential, and the embers are there to fight back. We really just need to bring those groups of people together, bring that labor movement together to fight for our rights. If SEIU can call for a strike for Black lives, which, I mean, it was mostly a protest, but we called for a strike for Black lives, we can have a strike for healthcare. We can have a strike for our lives against this pandemic. And it's possible to have that and to have a political organization that represents the labor movement, that represents the Black community, Latino community, oppressed people, immigrants, queer communities that come all together to defend our rights. But there's no way we can do that with the capitalist, imperialist Democratic Party and Republican parties.
Yeah, I'm speaking as a rank and file member the unions, our unions have to do much more. All the unions need to coalesce, maybe call for a general strike to address this crisis, to address the crisis of essential workers. We have a lot of work to do, and I'm hoping that we could call for a coalescing of all labor to address this crisis of not only this public health crisis and this mental health crisis, but also the economic crisis that we are. But again, we have to lower that hammer. You know, we have to keep lowering the hammer and seek out our victories.
LA mental health care workers Julia Wallace and Lawrence Reyes, members of SEIU 721. They are working to manage the raging COVID-19 pandemic and protect the lives of their clients and the public. They argue that there are fundamentally structural changes needed to solve this crisis. Cal OSHA is in a death agony with less than 200 inspectors for California's 18 million workers. You're listening to COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt.
This is a spoken word libation. So first, we give thanks and praise to the one who created all things, the one who said, but be, and it is. And we give honor to those who practice Jalia, the art of storytelling. Aesop, Mary Carter Smith, Brother Blue, Bala Fasike, Linda Brown, and we say Ashe, Ashe. And we give thanks to the word seed as it crossed the waters from Africa and came to these lands. Harriet Tubman, and gave rise to feet a-running. Tice Davis, Jane Lewis, William Parker, and we say Ashe. We give honor to those who use the word and courage to speak out. Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, Marcus Garvey, and we say Ashe. We give honor to those who took the word, put it in pen, and spoke for us to raise up, to reaffirm, and recommit. James Baldwin, Paul Robeson, who sang out and bellowed. Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Armstrong, Michael Jackson, and we say Ashe. And we also pour libation to those who are yet unborn, whose soul is yet but a whisper in God's breath. And we say, Ashe.
Ashe. another joy as we sing of the love togetherness can surely bring emotion. Set the table, no matter strong, thankful for the first fruits of the year. This day I light a candle just for you. Come join the party, it's a celebration. Karamu at Kwanzaa time of year. Red and yellow, black or white, Yoro, it's alright. It's a celebration that should last throughout the year. Happy Kwanzaa.
Happy Kwanzaa.
All right. Together there is so much we can do.
Happy Kwanzaa.
Happy Kwanzaa.
Kwanzaa celebrates African American heritage, family, and culture around the world, December 26th through January the 1st. It was created by Dr. Mayalana Karinga based on harvest festival traditions from the African diaspora. Kwanzaa began in 1966. Bukin Nyerere of the National Association of Kawaida Organizations, NACO, has been teaching the principles of Kwanzaa for several decades. Here, he reflects on the significance of Kwanzaa.
Well, I'm an advocate of Kawaida. I was reading Dr. Mayalana Karinga. It was a magazine. It was called Black Scholar. And I read some of his articles. And what happened was I found out that he was saying what I was thinking. And the articulation of it was the way I wish I could talk. At a African history scholars meeting in Chicago, I got to see him and I was more enthralled. When I got back to New York, some of us who knew each other as activists had meetings over a period of 2 years. And then out of that came the National Association of Kawaida Organizations in different parts that would study Kawaida, the philosophy, which means Kawaida being a synthesis word, simply meaning the best of African tradition and reasoning. We formulated a group since 1988. We've been together. We've become clearer on different issues that we all supported and would give a national outreach to. In 1966, Dr. Karinga created Kwanzaa, and it has grown steadily. And it's grown nationally and internationally as a practice to observe, one, that which would bring us together and a spirit in which we could celebrate our Africanness. The fact that there was a need to address our culture, how that would relate to how we deal with the world and our historic issues with our oppression.
Talk to us about some of the activities you guys have been engaged in over the years.
What we've done is we brought in scholars, we brought in medical people to discuss issues such as the donation of your organs upon death, medical insurance, and things like that. We do programs that cover the political spectrum, whether that's international or national, to bring more clarity and support, a way of defining how we see things philosophically. And one of the reasons is people may challenge what you're thinking. You begin to strengthen yourself by knowing why you practice a certain way of life, because nobody challenges why people support Hanukkah or Cinco de Mayo. Nobody challenges those practices naturally from the oppressor or those that embrace that thinking. They want you to explain why you would be so focused on keeping your identity, seeking out the knowledge of yourself from a lost memory.
I remember in maybe the late 90s or around that time, maybe mid-90s, there was a lot of discussion and debate. Was Kwanzaa to replace Christmas?
Yeah.
Was Kwanzaa, what's your response? And help us understand the basis of Kwanzaa.
Well, one thing is that we live in a Christian culture. And regardless of whether you practice Islam, whether you are a Christian, whether you are Jewish or Baha'i or Mahatian in our sacred passage, this is a cultural holiday in which we come together to really reflect and project on our Africanness as a people. So it's cultural, it has nothing to do with religion. There are certain rituals that are founded even in the seven principles of the Nguza Saba, like as such as when one celebrates Umoja, unity, Kujichagulia, self-determination, or go to the last principle, which is faith. These are just an ingathering of thought and practice that comes out of guidelines of what do you accept your behavior, not only from your own thinking, but how you interact with other people.
Here we are in the era of many pandemics, reckoning with racial justice, dealing with the impact of COVID-19. With African-American communities suffering at a higher alarming rate, more so than other communities, how can one still embrace these principles and strengthen our community despite all of what we see COVID-19 in America?
That last principle in Kwanzaa or the Nguza Saba, which is faith, you fight for that just like you fight for the ability to unify, to see the uniformity and that which we have lost. Starts by your faith that how you've lived this life has a lot of history to it, has the past and the loss of memory, that which is so important.
Again, when they argue why Kwanzaa over all the others, and I heard some scholars debate this issue and say every single holiday we celebrate, they're man-made holidays, every single one.
Yeah, they are. But one needs to understand, but you know, what we've done as a creative people is always take on just whatever practice is going down and made this just a day of where a family gathering, where you get to interact with your family, but not also recognize that most thoughts come out of one human to another. The divinity process, we would have to have a better debate about that, a more open debate about that. But all holidays are created by man.
Brother Nukim Nyerere, thank you very much for being with us. And
okay.
State with us the name of your...
My name is Bokim Nyerere. I'm from the New York chapter of the National Association of Kawaida Organizations. The website that would put people mostly into us is www.iaafestival.org. www.iaafestival.org. Email address would be nako@yahoo.com.
Unguzo Saba.
As an African-American and Pan-African holiday celebrated by millions throughout the world, Kwanzaa brings a cultural message which speaks to the best of what it means to be African and human in the fullest sense, says the creator of Kwanzaa, Dr. Maolana Karinga.
Kwanzaa is a Pan-African and African-American holiday that is a celebration of family, community, and culture. It is organized around seven fundamental principles and is a seven-day holiday that begins from December the 26th and goes to January 1st. And it's 7 days to, in fact, teach the seven principles, okay, which are in Swahili and then in English. Umoja, unity. Kujichagulia, self-determination. Ujima, collective work and responsibility. Ujamaa, cooperative economics. Nia, purpose. Kumba, creativity. And Imani, faith. And so I created Kwanzaa for three basic reasons. First, to reaffirm our rootedness in African culture. Because even though we are African people, due to the Holocaust of enslavement, we were lifted out of our own history and made a footnote and forgotten casualty in European history. And so the struggle we were waging, as Cabral said, is to return to our history and to use it to enrich and expand our lives. Secondly, I created Kwanzaa in order to give us a time when we as African people all over the world could come together, reaffirm the bonds between us, and meditate on the meaning and awesome responsibility of being African in the world. And certainly it has flowered because of that. Because if you look at how it has grown, over 28 million people celebrate this holiday on every continent in the world, throughout the world African community. And the third reason I created Kwanzaa was to introduce and reinforce the importance of African culture and African communitarian values. And by communitarian values, I mean values that stress and strengthen family, community, and culture. These are our strength. And at the hub and hinge on which this holiday turns, of course, and the central values are the Nguzo Saba, which we said earlier are Umoja unity, Kujichagulia self-determination, Ujima collective work and responsibility, Ujamaa cooperative economics, Nia purpose, Kumba creativity, and Imani faith.
According to Dr. Mylana Karinga, the last day of Kwanzaa is the first day of the new year, January 1st. Historically, this has been for African people a time of assessment of things done and things to do, of self-reflection and reflection on the life and future of the people and of recommitment to their highest cultural values in a special way. Visit the official Kwanzaa website, an authoritative source for accurate and expansive information on its origins, concepts, values, symbols, and practice at officialkwanzawebsite.org. The Pacifica National Board voted unanimously to develop a transformative program that bridged voices of the people throughout the network, highlighting the enormous scale and life-altering challenges we face from the lack of governmental leadership in the midst of two horrific pandemics. We have worked tirelessly to accomplish that goal, and with your support, the COVID Race and Democracy Production Team will continue to lift the voices of the people. As we close 2020, we thank you for your support. This concludes our special edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all Pacifica stations and affiliates who made contributions to this production. Special thanks to the Pacifica COVID Task Force. You can find this and all previous episodes on our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Today's show was produced by Steve Zeltzer and Akua Holt. Our editors were Paulina Vasiliev and Lona Elias. Executive producers are Steve Zeltzer, Paulina Vasiliev, and Akua Holt. Special thanks to producers Jacqueline Baptiste, Lona Elias, Verna Avery Brown, Ann Garrison, and Fahima Sack. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. I leave you with a quote by Gwendolyn Brooks. We are each other's magnitude and bond. Thank you.